Last February, the president sent a signal.
The drawdown of our military should send a clear signal that Iraq's future is now its own responsibility. The long-term success of the Iraqi nation will depend on decisions made by Iraq's leaders and the fortitude of the Iraqi people.
Yesterday's bloody signal from suicide bombers in Baghdad sorely tested the fortitude of those Iraqi people. Escalating chaos reveals vulnerable civilians, a vulnerable Iraqi government, and an Obama administration vulnerable on its policy in Iraq. Baghdad is suddenly a target-rich environment. But we knew that on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. We'll take a look at those targets in Baghdad. It's Monday, October 26th. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. Coming up, can the U.S. pull its troops out of Iraq if the cities aren't safe there? Also, why declaring a state of emergency is not an emergency? The East Coast gets an I-95 World Series, and how do you divide up chores in your home? Forget mom and dad. Turns out daughters do more chores and get paid less for it than their brothers. Pay discrimination in the living room.
But first, we're joined by Joost Hilterman, who's Deputy Program Director for the Middle East and North Africa with the International Crisis Group. Joost, first of all, thanks for joining us. And what is the clear message sent by the perpetrators of this bloody bombing in Baghdad, do you think?
Good morning, John. Yeah, I think the message is that it's directed at the Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, and it says, Mr. al-Maliki, we can get rid of you. Even if we cannot kill you, we can puncture your image as the man who brought peace to Iraq, and you will lose at the elections.
And those elections are in January, and we're going to talk about them with Joost Hilterman and someone from Baghdad in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to hear this morning.
In the headlines, the U.S. military says 14 Americans are dead after a series of helicopter crashes in Afghanistan today. Seven U.S. troopers and three civilians died in the first crash. The Taliban say they shot down a helicopter in the region. The U.S. has not commented on the cause of that crash. President Obama meets with the security team again today to talk about the military strategy in Afghanistan. And that's as Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold says he'll build a coalition in the Senate to block any increase in troop levels in Afghanistan.
Meanwhile, as we've been saying, it's been a very violent weekend in Iraq. The death toll in twin suicide bombings there has risen to more than 150. In sports over the weekend, the Yankees are headed to the World Series. They beat the LA Angels in Game 6 of the American League Championship Series last night to clinch their spot. The Yanks will face the Philadelphia Phillies in Game 1 of the World Series, which begins on Wednesday. At The Hague, former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic was supposed to stand trial for war crimes today, but UN judges abruptly adjourned the trial after Karadzic boycotted it. Markets closed slightly down on Friday. The Dow opens this morning at 99.72. The S&P starts trading at 1080, and the Nasdaq begins at 21.54. So you may have thought about it, but can you actually take the plunge and live without a credit card? What would it take? What would you lose? What would you have to restrict in your financial behavior? Cynthia emailed us, not having a credit card is possible, of course, but extremely inconvenient. Just try to rent a car without one. I borrow money every month from Visa and pay it back promptly when the bill comes due. Then I cash in the air mileage earned every few years until the rules change. My credit card is a bargain. But could you live without one? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You already do, right?
I do.
You already do. So we've got one. We've got one person right
now. Let's
take a
poll among the control room.
Keep calling. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, everyone. Well, Celeste, we hadn't heard this ugly sound in Baghdad barely 24 hours ago. We haven't heard this sound in quite a while. That's the sound on a shaky mobile phone obtained by the Associated Press of the second of two suicide bombs that struck near the fortified Green Zone in Baghdad. The death toll from these attacks keeps rising. It's above 150 as of this morning. The tactics are familiar. A first bomb followed by a second bomb, you'll recall, as rescuers come to the scene and the second bomb detonates, multiplying the number of casualties. And, of course, these bombings take place as Iraq is preparing for elections in January.
Right. Although they may be delayed.
Yeah,
right.
We've already heard that they may be delayed, so that is a fragile process that may be threatened here. The security forces trying to demonstrate that they can ensure security for the people of Iraq.
Nouri al-Maliki is trying to say Iraq is a stable country. He's taking down blast walls. Things are returning to normal life in Iraq.
And the Obama administration trying to enforce its withdrawal of troops from the cities. All of this is affected or potentially targeted by these attacks. But first joining us is Jane Araf, the Iraq correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor and Middle East editor for Global Post. Jane, good morning there in Baghdad, and give us a sense of the scene of what's going on this morning.
Good morning, John. It's a typical Baghdad thing in that yesterday, if you had been there yesterday and I was walking around shortly after the blast, it was absolutely horrific. Literally blood flowing in the streets, mangled bodies, mangled cars. The scene today is very different because there is a tendency here to figuratively and literally sweep things away as quickly as possible. It looks relatively normal except for the blackened hulks of these buildings, which essentially have been destroyed. There isn't a whole lot of work going on in those ministries. And in the streets, the same feeling there has been since that huge August 19th bombing at two other ministries that we're in for quite a dangerous period of time.
Is there clarity, Jane, as to who did this, who carried out these bombings? And were people expecting, a shoe to drop here for violence to escalate as U.S. troops withdraw from the cities?
They are expecting it, and not just as U.S. troops withdraw, but as the elections come closer, as you mentioned. There is very rarely clarity here, but there's very often a consensus, and the consensus among the government certainly is that this was carried out by al-Qaeda in Iraq and planned, perhaps, by ex-Baathists. Those are the usual suspects that they turn to. This had very much the hallmarks of an al-Qaeda attack, the amount of explosives used, the coordination. When I talked to people in the streets yesterday, they were blaming it on other countries, blaming it on the U.S., and perhaps for the first time, blaming it on their own government. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is still quite popular in the streets, but they were saying that it was the government that has failed to protect them, along with the United States.
Now, Washington officials were quick to say that the Iraqi people are opposed to these kinds of attacks and can weather the storm and move forward. Is that what you're hearing on the streets?
That's a really interesting view, and it's a little bit cynical, isn't it? Because, yes, of course, they can weather the attacks. They can move forward. They don't really have a choice. It's one step forward, two steps back many times. We're talking about a government that was essentially paralyzed to begin with. There are not a whole lot of decisions being made here. There are not a lot of functioning ministries the way they think they are, the way that we tend to think they are. And the U.S. is very much facing a deadline. It's very worried about that deadline, which is why we see these repeated statements that Parliament must pass an election law.
You're referring to the 2010.
There are a lot of things that have to happen.
The 2010 deadline you're referring to for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. Jane Araf, the Iraq correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, Middle East editor for Global Post, who joined us from Baghdad. Jane, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
So the question for regional diplomats and policymakers in Washington and Iraq is, does more of this... Again, that's the sound from those twin suicide bombings in Baghdad yesterday. Does more of that complicate Iraq's plans for elections next January? Does it inflame divisions between central Iraq and northern Kurdistan, for instance, or between Sunni and Shiite factions? Does it slow down the pace of the U.S. withdrawal of troops? Senator John McCain doesn't think so.
It's extremists trying to ignite sectarian violence is what's going on. But they've still got a ways to go, but it's not going to require any delay in withdrawal of U.S. troops.
We're here again with Joost Hilterman, Deputy Program Director for the Middle East and North Africa with the International Crisis Group. Joost, you just heard Jane Araf suggesting that the Iraqi people, no matter what American policymakers may say about them being willing to weather the storm, have absolutely no choice. Does the U.S. government have a choice in slowing down the withdrawal of troops here in the face of these bombings?
Well, I think that the domestic pressures in the United States are such that it would be very difficult for President Obama to slow down the troop withdrawals. But I think at the same time that it should be given some consideration, not to stop the withdrawals, but to reconsider the timetable, because security remains unstable. And more importantly, we're about to face a major political crisis in Iraq around the elections and the formation of a new government.
Now, Jane Araf was saying that Nouri al-Maliki is popular on the streets of Baghdad and in Iraq. If the election were held today, do you think he would win?
I think he would have a good chance, but his alliance is not the only one running, obviously. He faces some formidable foes. So he may end up being the largest group and being designated to form the new government, but he certainly would have trouble forming a government because he must find other groups to ally himself with.
And where are the fractures then? Because it's a little puzzling to me what the threshold point is for the people who are carrying out these attacks. Do they want the elections to be delayed? Do they want Iraq to just sort of fall apart? Do they want to bring down Maliki? Or do they just want to make delays and then for propaganda purposes say, hey, look what we did?
Well, I think it's the latter point, mostly. I think they want to disrupt the political process. They want to puncture Mr. Maliki's image as the man who brought peace to Iraq, but it's not directed at Maliki specifically. They would do it against anyone leading the government today. So they want to make sure that everybody knows that they're still around and that their demands are not being heard and being answered.
Is this? I assume this is a completely separate fight from what's going on inside the parliament, where they can't agree on number one votes in Kurdish territories, but also on whether or not people can vote by party and whether they have to list individual candidates. That's a separate issue.
It is a separate issue. It is a separate issue. But I would say that Mr. Maliki's opponents, who are plentiful and who are, of course, also in the parliament, certainly would take advantage of these bombings, even though they would never come out and say that. And already they have done it to say that Mr. Maliki is not a leader who can bring security to Iraq. And so all of these games start overlapping and intertwining.
Well, Joost Hilterman, Deputy Program Director for the Middle East and North Africa with the International Crisis Group. He's speaking to us from Washington, D.C. You know, Celeste raises an interesting point there. As we've seen in Afghanistan, the Taliban, which has attacked institutions inside Afghanistan, prefers to remain outside of the political process.
Right.
If these are Baathists in Iraq who are responsible for this disruption, are they insisting on staying outside the political process? We'll call for a boycott of elections, or is there some deal that can be negotiated to bring them into the government in some way?
I think they need to be marginalized. These are a fairly small group, but very powerful, because they have their hands on powerful explosives, as we saw,
sure.
Because there is a lot of unsecured material still from 2003, from the war. And so they can do this. But the key is the remainder of the Sunni community, or the majority of the Sunni community, and where their loyalty lies. And these bombs, in a way, are also aimed at telling these people there's no point in joining this Shiite government, and they will never govern Iraq and provide protection for everyone, including for you. And so you should be with us.
All right, then that raises another point, and that is the threshold here to re-engage and re-inflame the sectarian violence that was so destabilizing in 2004 and 2005 in Iraq between Sunnis and Shia? I mean, Al-Qaeda and the Baathists are Sunni, but can they really sort of trigger something much broader?
I doubt very much that they at this point would be able to trigger sectarian violence. That is not really it may be part of the aim, but it's not a realistic aim. What is more realistic is to generally disrupt the political process and to show to everyone that Iraq cannot be governed. And that therefore, because there's a notion that the Shiites are incapable of governing, that it's time to bring Sunnis back to power because they have always governed Iraq.
All right. The U.S. is backing Nouri al-Maliki and is backing this election process. From your perspective, Joost Hilterman, what is the U.S. government getting wrong in Iraq based on this attack?
Well, I think what they're getting wrong is the idea that they can leave without leaving behind something that is sustainable. What they need to do is to continue to build up Iraqi forces, and they need, most importantly, to mediate a set of political deals between Iraqi actors on the disputed territories in the north, which are claimed by the Kurds, and on power sharing, and also on how oil is managed and the
Indeed.
Revenues of oil sales are shared.
Well, familiar issues, familiar challenges for both the Iraqi government and the U.S. government. Joost Hilterman is Deputy Program Director for the Middle East and North Africa with the International Crisis Group, talking about how those challenges change or get more difficult in the wake of the twin suicide bombings that killed more than 150 people in Baghdad yesterday. Joost, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253. Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.